April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
How do we help students become confident readers? What meaningful conversations should we have to overcome barriers to equity and inclusivity in the classroom? Welcome to Season 4 of Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. This season, we're exploring important topics that impact our students every day: reading acceleration and recovery, inclusivity, and meeting students just where they're at on their reading journey. We've lined up an amazing team of experts who will inspire you as they share their perspectives to find fresh ways to help you support your students. This season, we're also honoring educators who have driven change in their district by successfully implementing the Science of Reading. You'll hear from winners of the Amplify Science of Reading Star Awards as they share their experiences fighting for students when no one else would. The Science of Reading movement continues to grow, and as educators, we will continue to grow with it. It's vital that we focus on research-based practices to deliver classroom instruction that allows students to learn. The more we learn and listen, the more we'll be prepared to lead. Our students are counting on us. Today, Dr. Sheila Clonan joins us to talk about students who struggle with reading and how that struggle impacts entire families. She is a certified school psychologist with over 20 years of experience in public school and university settings. Dr. Clonan is currently in private practice, specializing in the assessment of students with dyslexia, ADHD, and other disabilities. She's a knowledgeable and passionate advocate for children with disabilities, their families, and teachers. Sheila, welcome to our podcast episode today. We're so honored to have you join us.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
As you know, we always like to ask folks to start off by telling our listeners just a little bit about your journey into, you know, why is it that the science of reading or reading, like, what's the context? How did you end up in this world?
Oh, this is one of my favorite stories. It's a little bit overtold, actually.
Oh, my.
But I mean, here's a new preface that I don't usually use. I was one of those kids who, and adults, I love reading. It is by far my favorite pastime. And I went to school knowing how to read. And I have always been a reader, and it was something that came very easy to me. And so, you know, I didn't really realize that there were people who really struggled that much. Mm. And so then my career started as a school psychologist in an urban school near me. And, you know, right away I was getting lots of referrals, a lot of kids with behavior problems or reading problems, and usually both, you know, the kids that were referred for so-called behavior problems usually had reading problems. And I would do my wonderful diagnostic test and I would say, this child has a learning disability. And I felt like the teachers and the parents were, you know, kind of like, well, yeah, obviously, now what? What do we do? And they were looking for more help, for more information. And I didn't have that part. And I was feeling kind of inadequate because you could see these kids struggling. You could see that, I mean, the reason the teachers referred them was because they couldn't help them, right? And they wanted to know what to do to help them. And, you know, I mean, I could have said, I guess that's not my job. My job is to tell you what's wrong, but it just felt woefully inadequate. So ultimately, really only after just a couple of years in public schools, I did go back for my doctorate. I stayed in the public schools while I did that, but I actually gave serious thought to getting a doctorate in reading and literacy because it was already fascinating me so much. But I looked and there were a number of reasons I stuck with school psychology. Not the least of which was I would have the opportunity at Syracuse University to take courses with Benita Blackman. So while she was actually on the reading and language arts faculty, I could take courses with her. And for any of your readers who may not have heard of Benita, she's one of the pioneering researchers in early literacy. So I took some courses with her. I finished my doctorate. And then I actually did finally leave the public schools and I did a postdoc fellowship that was managing a research project that Benita was running, but it was a multi-site study together with Bennett and Sally Shaywitz at the Yale Child Study Center, which is now the Yale Study for Dyslexia and Creativity, as well as Barbara Foreman at Florida. I mean, just really all of the pioneers in the research, reading research field. And here I was just, I'm postdoc, right? So I'm still young, quite inexperienced. I've been a school psychologist for maybe 8-9 years at this point. And I'm newly minted doctoral, candidate or person. So that was the beginning and kind of my awakening. But simultaneously through that, I was dating and ultimately married a wonderful man who kind of early on, I said, I think you have a learning disability in reading, because that was my school psych language. And he said, you just think I'm dumb. Like that's mean. You think I'm dumb. And I said, no, actually, I think you're absolutely brilliant. And so your writing and your spelling doesn't convey that. Like, I think there's something going on. But in this training and the work that I was starting to do with Benita, I showed him an article by the Shaywitzes. Now I'm going to date us. 1991 Scientific American, which was about dyslexia. And it was much more, user-friendly than most of the stuff being written at that time. And I handed it to him and he read it and he said, this is me. And I said, yeah, I know. Mm. So this was sort of simultaneous. I'm getting to work with the giants in the field and I'm seeing it play out. And then ultimately it plays out in my family. So, true to statistics, half of my children, half of the four have dyslexia. So it's been kind of
what a story.
Professional, yeah. Professional and personal passion for quite a few years now.
For sure. So for some of our listeners that don't understand the significance of these big names, can you talk a little bit about the work of Benita, the work about the Shaywitz, the work about Barbara Foreman, just really briefly?
Yep. Well, I mean, actually, the best way to do that would be to tell you what the study was, because Benita at the time had been well known for early literacy intervention and teaching struggling readers to read. And the Shaywitzes were very big in dyslexia. And the neurobiology research was relatively new at that time. And so the study that I was able to manage and coordinate for them was the neurobiology of reading intervention. And we did fMRIs of the kids before and after the 1-year intensive reading intervention, which was based on Benita's work at our site. In the Florida site, it was based on Barbara Foreman's work, all similar, systematic, explicit, phonologically based reading instruction. And I got to accompany these kids, who most of whom had never been on a plane, from Syracuse to Connecticut to go to Yale and have their brain scans. And in short, The study did show that not only did the kids, improve their reading by a couple of grade levels, they rewired their brains to look more like good readers.
That's a pretty powerful statement that you just said here, because we have been talking a lot on this podcast, probably several episodes, we've referred to the fact that kids need to rewire their brains. So what you're saying is that that's actually what's happening.
Yep. We've seen it. It's cool.
That's really amazing. And now I have to go to the personal side of it, because apparently your question to your now husband wasn't offensive to him and he kept dating you or decided that you guys wanted to get married.
Well, when I did, it's funny to me, and he still doesn't like the word learning disability or the phrase learning disability. So it is funny. I mean, I think it was a little bit offensive when I used the words learning disability to him, because his immediate reaction was to cover up and to say, no, you just think I'm dumb. And that comes from his history of having felt dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to actually come back to that concept and unpack that concept a little bit more. And just an important topic about the episode here. But does it sometimes when you look back on and think about this, feel like, wow, how did this path actually emerge and put me in this place right now?
Yes, 100%. And I feel blessed to be where I am every single day. And I've kind of evolved or changed the parts of this that I'm in, of the science of reading that I'm involved in. I went from coordinating that research project to being a university professor and doing my own research to now being in private practice. And I'm not actively involved in research anymore. I keep up with the research, but I'm not actively doing research, which, I'm watching kids and anecdotally I'm seeing things and going, oh, I really want to study that. But I don't have the sort of time incentive to do that now. It's now get the reports done.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that work that you're doing. So in private practice, how does the work that you're doing actually fit in the context then of what we call the science of reading?
That's a great question. My assessments, so I'm seeing mostly kids with dyslexia. I have people come from pretty big distances to see me to diagnose, suspected dyslexia. And so that is the bulk of my practice, although certainly I'm open to any disability areas. And so when I'm doing, though, a suspected dyslexia assessment in particular, I am embedding that assessment explicitly now in the science of reading. And so what I mean by that is I literally, even in my reports, talk about the simple view of reading. And so if decoding times language equals reading comprehension, then how do I ascertain where the breakdown is? Is there a decoding breakdown? Is there a language breakdown? And so I systematically walk through. So the ways that we would address decoding would be first phonemic awareness, and I use the hierarchy of skills and assess them. And the report is actually framed around the simple view of reading in terms of determining where the child struggles. And I have found this to be extremely useful because while I've always kind of thought of it that way, I haven't structured my reports that way. And the reason I say it's very useful is because oftentimes the kids I'm seeing and now recognize in private practice, I'm seeing a fairly skewed clientele, right? If it was very, very disabling, very obvious, the school districts would have already identified the children. So it's skewed in that way. I tend to get more subtle cases, not always, but somewhat. And then it's also, unfortunately, rather skewed towards higher income or at least higher people with higher the social capital to understand that they can request the school district pay for their evaluation, right? So they have more resources, whether they're financial or social. Anyway, the cases that I get do tend to be more subtle. And so if the school has tested the child, they'll see, the reading comprehension is above average. Yeah, word reading is kind of a little bit low, but that's okay because he can understand the text, you know? And so when I go in and I say, but look, the listening comprehension, is 135. Sure, the reading comprehension is 100. But by the way, you don't have to really understand a passage to do well on a reading comprehension subtest. And there's this really big gap between what the child knows when he listens to something versus what he knows when he reads something. And then, by really explicitly applying the simple view of reading, I'm able to show that, that the word reading is impairing the reading comprehension, even if it looks okay. So that's one way I would say that I keep the science of reading in with what I'm doing. I mean, other than that, I'm involved with the Reading League. I'm a founding board member of the Reading League. And I just, even though I'm not currently doing research, I am constantly reading research.
Yeah. And I think you told me too that you do some webinars with the Reading League to help with sort of the professional development side of that. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. With the Reading League and with school districts and other organizations.
Let's go back to sort of this reporting thing or the assessment thing that you do with students. And I have a couple of questions about that before we just hop into a little more detail is so I know we shared that, I have a son that's dyslexic and it was really fourth grade where we ended up, going through that process to actually discover the dyslexia. What do you notice about the age of the kids that are coming to you and what are they coming to you with issues in?
Really good question. And a hard one to answer. So I think I would say that over the past 2 years or so, the age range has broadened out to include younger children because parents seem to be coming in more knowledgeable saying, I'm suspecting dyslexia. Whereas initially, and still sometimes the case is I was getting kids who were older and, so by older, I mean like even really 7th, 9th, 11th grades. I kind of call it the odd years or the wall years, right? 3rd, 5th, 7th, 9th, and 11th. It's going to hit them one of those years. Traditionally, we think of 3rd grade as it's always been, even in the school systems, we always thought about that as one of the hard years because you switch from learning to read to reading to learn. What's fascinating to me about that, though, is that's where my compensators, my high-functioning dyslexics go underground. Nobody's listening to them read anymore. they actually start to look better.
Fascinating.
So when I'm asking a parent for a history of a reading problem, and they'll say, no, you know, reads all the time, or, you know, it seems fine. Like, does his work, gets good grades in reading. But if I ask, were they maybe a little bit slower to pick up the concept of reading or avoided it as a younger child? And most of them will say, oh yeah, they were in, you know, academic supports until third grade, and then they were fine, because nobody's listening to them read, and they are compensating with their strong language comprehension to be successful students, but they're still struggling with reading and writing. So I'm sorry. Every question you ask me, I have a segue. I apologize.
You're doing great.
So the age range, the older, when it was and still is sometimes older students, so one of those wall years, as I call them. So if they were able to fly under the radar in third grade and fifth grade, it often hits in seventh grade for one of my own. It really, I mean, I knew all along that he was dyslexic, but in terms of needing support at school, accommodations, it hit in seventh grade because I was having to read his social studies textbook to him. And that was very labor intensive. So he needed accommodations. So that's a hard year. And then ninth grade is another one where, you know, the writing demands. And it seems to me that it's all of a sudden people are going, wow, this kid can't spell. And I'm thinking, they haven't been able to spell since third grade. But ninth grade is a year where they're doing much more intensive writing and people are noticing it.
Yeah. I was just going to say that you said that now it's skewing younger. Is there a reason that you think that it's skewing younger that you're seeing those students?
I suppose there could be a number of factors, but what I think I'm noticing is that parents are coming to me more knowledgeable. They're saying, I am seeing these signs and I'm afraid my child's dyslexic. Whereas before, some of those older kids, and this was what I was going to say when we were interrupting each other, were kind of coming for more like anxiety, or the parents were like, we're not sure what's wrong. Or maybe they had accommodations in school for anxiety, but the parents kind of knew there was something else. They just couldn't put their finger on it. Now they're saying, I've read up on these signs of dyslexia, and I think my child is showing this in my school. You know, says we don't test for dyslexia, or tested them and said nothing's wrong, or tested them and said they have a learning disability, but I think it's something else. So now I'm seeing, that's what I meant by the maybe a bit more younger children, because the parents seem to be more aware now.
That's interesting. And for our listeners, just can you like just talk to us quickly about what dyslexia is, and maybe a couple of the misconceptions before we talk about sort of the behaviors and how it manifests?
Absolutely. So, I mean, literally from the Latin roots, dys means difficulty and lexia means words, right? So it's difficulty with words, quite literally. And that kind of encapsulates it, but also could be misleading if we think about words as the in their visual sense. So we need to think about words from the language sense. So it's a language-based learning disability. So it is a learning disability, as much as my husband and other people don't like those terms applied to them. It's a language-based learning disability characterized by deficits in phonological awareness, the awareness that the world that we live in, that language can be broken up into individual sounds. Language-based learning disability characterized by deficits in phonological awareness, difficulty matching letters to sounds, sometimes difficulty discriminating between similar sounds, decoding unknown words, and some inaccuracies in word reading and spelling, and oftentimes poor fluency. And then I like to pull from, I mean, all of that is encapsulated in the dyslexia definition that's in the International Dyslexia Association. But I also like to remind people that I love the wording that they have on that definition, which is, may include secondary consequences or secondary deficits in reading comprehension. So if the child has a primary deficit in reading comprehension and no word reading deficit, that's a language issue, not dyslexia. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
And then secondarily, some of these kids don't read as much. And so the vocabulary goes down and the background knowledge goes down, but that's also a secondary consequence. And what's not in the IDA definition that I also like to add is secondary consequences also include potentially anxiety, frustration, depression.
We will talk about that next. Before we go there, I've heard a lot about this idea of the gifts of dyslexia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So I have mixed feelings there, to be perfectly fair. I feel the allure of, right? I feel the allure of the gifts. But I feel like we're doing our kids and ourselves a disservice for a number of reasons, not the least of which is while anecdotally, I see a lot of that. I've read some work that I can go, yeah, I agree. I see that. But I haven't seen any evidence base yet. I've seen a lot of really nicely written books, you know, chronicling people's experiences and summarizing some things, but not a strong, solid evidence base that dyslexia concurs these particular gifts. So there's that. But I think my bigger concern, so let's say the evidence ultimately does corroborate some of that, and it might. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but it currently we're not there, to my knowledge. But my bigger concern is when we say, for example, oh, okay, so you have dyslexia, which makes it hard for you to read, but it also gives you these gifts. I think that that takes the ownership of the gifts away from the child or the person with dyslexia. And I don't know, I'm not going to give that away, right? I'm going to say you have gifts. You have difficulty reading and you have this incredible talent for X, Y, or Z. And I think that's important for a sort of a sense of agency.
Yeah. Not giving the gift to dyslexia, but giving to the gift to the individual.
Yes.
Yeah. That's lovely. That feels really, really great. So we're talking about, you know, reading is one of the most important things that we can do to feel like we're part of, well, for sure, when we're in our early grades, that we're part of a school community, part of a classroom community, that we're empowered to interact in that community. And when you feel uncomfortable with words or uncomfortable with text, that's got to be a difficult position to be in. So you talked a little bit about identifying kids based on behaviors, or, you know, you talked a little bit about your husband saying, "What, you're calling me dumb." So what is the affect or the emotional element of this for a child that has dyslexia?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's individual and it varies. But I do think for most kids, at least initially and until they really get, if hopefully they get it identified well and clearly with, you know, by someone who says, these are your learning strengths, these are your learning challenges, here's what you need to do the best you can. And quite literally what I say to some kids is, you know, school is the only time in your life where you're expected to be equally good at everything and fast at it. Once you get out of school, you can specialize, and, you know, and even to a certain extent in college, you can specialize, you can have a secretary to do the writing or the reading, you know, and now we have so many easy technological accommodations. So that's part of it. But I'd like to explain the emotional impact of dyslexia with, I have two little analogies. So if you can bear with me on these, One is, imagine, you know, in your work life, you know, so you do these interviews and these podcasts, let's just say there's one part of that. You know, so you're good at most of it, but there's one part of your work life that you're very, very bad at, and it's very public. So in a sense, you are a good example because your work is quite public, right? So let's say maybe, you know, something about your speaking voice is not as good as everyone else's. I don't know what other analogy to draw, but something about the work that you do that's very public, you're not good at that. And everybody sees that every day. And you have to go to work for 6 hours a day and do that thing that you're not good at. So imagine what that feels like in your soul, right? And then imagine that you're going, you know, so you don't swim. So I'm going to put these two analogies together in a second, but let's say you can't swim. So you're going to the pool thinking you're going to get swim lessons, but instead they say, okay, everybody get in, start swimming. And you're a little bit cautious because you can't swim and you know that, but you get in the water because they keep yelling, all right, everybody in, hurry up, everybody in, now swim across, go to that side and come back, keep going, hurry up, try harder, get over there, come back. And that's what people are saying to you. Nobody's teaching you exactly how to swim, but they're telling you to do it. And you look around and everyone around you is actually getting across the pool and back, some faster, some slower, but they're all doing it and you can't. And that's your job, right? That's your day. That's what you're doing for 6.5 hours a day. Imagine what that does to your soul. So of course we're seeing anxiety, frustration, depression sometimes. And going back to, you know, when I said initially in the urban schools in particular, but, you know, really boys get identified with dyslexia at a higher rate than boy than girls because they are more likely to act out their frustration or their anger in girls. And again, of course, individual differences apply, but in general, girls are more likely to internalize those feelings and to become anxious or depressed.
And in your work specifically, currently, and then we'll talk about in the past, how has this impacted, you know, even your assessment of a child or your communication with the school about where this child is at? What have you specifically seen with kids?
First of all, when I start an assessment with a child, we start by, you know, having a clinical interview and talking about what's hard for them and what they like and what they dislike. And some of that will come out in that conversation. But some of these kids are so used to hiding this and protecting themselves that they don't. But when I start with testing, I sort of introduce that, you know, my job is to figure out the things that their brain has trouble processing and the things that come easily to them so that we can use those to help them help themselves and to help teachers and parents help them. But some of the kids, I mean, I'm thinking of a young lady that got identified in seventh grade. Her parents had her tested a couple of times, but she was really, really bright and hiding, you know, compensating really well. And she was very angry. She didn't want to come see me. She didn't want to do the testing, you know, and I generally win kids over. This one, I mean, she did everything, but she remained quite angry. To the extent that when I was talking to her, her body was often turned away from me. And when we did the feedback session, I was expecting when I said to her, you know, you're dyslexic. And that means, you know, that your brain has trouble processing the language and connecting it to print. But look at how good you are at these other things. She was like, I don't want to hear this. I don't care. And we were like, well, you can get accommodations. I don't want their accommodations. Like literally everything about it made this child angry. So, you know, it runs the gamut. I've got other kids who kind of like think it's cool to think about, you know, I have a little brain model and to think about how their brain works and okay, I'm going to listen to stories instead of read them. A lot of my kids are coming in already enjoying listening to books. And so hearing that that can be one of their accommodations feels like, oh, it's not cheating, you know, so did that answer the question directly? I'm sorry. You were talking, you just asked me to talk about current clients. So.
Yeah, no. It actually does answer the question because I'm going to ask you a follow-up and then another follow-up. So I know when we did our pre-call, I asked you the same question. I thought it was really interesting. When you were actually in the school setting, what did that behavior look like for kids that were really struggling to read?
Oh, yes. So again, preponderance of boys acting out, acting up, getting sent out of class. And I think I probably told you this one because I will never, ever forget. I can picture his face still. The 16-year-old boy, when I was at one of the high schools saying, it's better to be bad than be stupid. Mm-hmm. Because it was sort of, you know, he'd already been identified, but like he would still act up when they were, I think, you know, 16, he must've been doing something in English class where they were, you know, like a play or a Romeo and Juliet or something where they were asked to read out loud and he got himself sent out and ended up with me instead of the principal, you know, so better to be bad than stupid, acting out, getting sent out.
So would you say that for the most part, that the kids that you've worked with at any time period, that they naturally equate, I can't read with I'm stupid?
Yeah. Way too many of them. Yes. Yes. You know, I want to give another example of a girl's reaction to this because it was equally as powerful as that young man, but very different. It was more the girl version, but she was 13. She was actually one of my first cases when I started full-time private practice. And she was really referred, the parents and the school had no idea. And it was really parent initiated. Nobody knew. I mean, she was really struggling in Spanish. But other than that, they didn't know what was going on. They thought it was all emotional. Like a social emotional problem of some sort. And she was sitting in her content classrooms with her hood up back to the teacher reading a book. Can you imagine the shock when I said this kid's dyslexic? And wow. I was shocked too. I mean, now I'm looking for those kinds of behaviors, but to be perfectly honest, when I asked her to read aloud, I almost fell over because she did it really quickly. but she didn't read the words that I saw on the page. She was kind of making up a story that was semi-related. I had to say to her, wow, you read so fast, I can't keep up with you. Would you mind if I made a recording of this so I can think about it later? Because I couldn't keep up with the number of errors that she made. So here she was, you know, kind of that internalizing behavior, ignoring teachers, ignoring the classroom environment, refusing to do her work, but shutting the world out by reading a book.
So that makes me want to ask this next question, which is, what happens? I mean, you gave us an example of the child that said, I don't care, I don't want to know about my learning disability. Have you had other experiences where this awareness for a kid and them starting to get support to, you know, develop as a better reader has actually had a positive impact on their life?
Lord, I hope so. I mean, I think so. Sorry, but I mean, I do think
so. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, I really hope so, and I believe so. But the reality is, I mean, I keep in touch with many of my clients, but most of those who keep in touch with me, it's because they still need help. So I'm, again, skewed towards the more negative outcomes. That said, I mean, certainly, as I said with the other case, I mean, I do feedback conferences with the parent. And if the child is 12 or above, routinely with them. If they're younger, if the parents want it, I'll also do it with them. And so, you know, I feel like sometimes it feels like a relief. I know it's almost always a relief to the parents. For the children, I hope and believe that sometimes it feels like a relief to them, but I don't always get to see the longer term positive impact, but I believe that it's there and I hope that it's there.
It's one of the most difficult things about our work, isn't it? That, that we're planting the seeds, we're trying to do the right thing, but oftentimes we don't know the outcome.
Yes. Yes.
Let's make a little bit of a transition. So we've really talked about the challenges of what it must be like for a child to have this. We talked a little bit about the parents. Talk to me a little bit about the parents and what sort of the emotions that they go through in this process.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I've witnessed this with many, many parents that it's so painful for them. You know, they go through a process of, you know, noticing when their child is quite young, I think something's wrong, and maybe talking to the kindergarten or first grade teacher and being told, oh, you know, they're young, you know, she's fine. He'll outgrow it. He'll come along. Don't worry. And then, you know, again, the next year, well, we're still kind of concerned. We feel, you know, this is what we're seeing at home. It's fine. You know, maybe we're getting some, you know, general ed intervention now too. And so, you know, the parents kind of go from trusting the school that it's going to get better to all of a sudden awakening and going, oh my gosh, this is not getting better. And now look how far behind my child is. And then worse, of course, is when the child is feeling it so severely, in the cases like we were just discussing, that they hate going to school, right? School is soul crushing to them. And the parent has to send them off to this soul crushing environment every single day. And that's nothing against educators, of course. I realize it comes across right. That way sometimes. And I don't mean that. And I don't mean also, you know, the fact that schools are often unable to identify these kids as a slam against schools. They're not there yet. They're coming. The knowledge is coming. And I'm so hopeful that things will get better for these kids and for their families and for their teachers. But right now, a lot of these kids are not getting identified adequately in school. And so, you know, going off to that environment, to that swim lesson where you can't swim and everyone else can, and you're, you know, still not figuring it out, can really be soul crushing for these kids. And so for the parent to watch that happen day after day and to be powerless to help them, and to be asking the people that you think know better to help them, and those people don't, in many cases, know better yet either. It's very, very hard on parents.
Yeah, and in my own personal experience, I mean, the same thing, right? I was told in kindergarten and first and second grade, it's going to get better in third grade, and it didn't get better. And knowing that the only place that I knew to reach out to was to the school, because I assumed them to be the experts when they weren't the experts. And then the guilt that yes. I felt myself, that how is it that I can't navigate or figure out what the best thing to do for my child? It's horrible.
Yeah, that That's a really, yes, I mean, awful point, but good point that I didn't realize, I didn't think to say, but you're absolutely right. Many of these parents feel very guilty that, especially because they kind of go like, I thought so, like, you know, since preschool, I've thought something was wrong and I let it go and I let it go and I let it go. So yeah, absolutely. The guilt is probably very, very hard.
Yeah. And I was going to make another really great point and comment and I forgot it. So,
sorry,
listeners, this is real world here. This is real world. I think then the, you know, messages for teachers here. So I think part of the point that I was going to make is you were talking about identification, even in my own personal experience. And what we know is two things. We know that strong core instruction from the minute the kids walk through the classroom, that's evidence-based, right? Based in science of reading practices is essential for all kids. But the other thing is the importance of really early intervention. And I know we didn't plan to talk about that, but can you say something about the importance? Because usually we wait for intervention until like, well, maybe second grade or, oh, maybe third grade or maybe fourth grade. But that intervention should come much earlier.
Yes, 100%. Because again, remember, everybody in kindergarten is just getting into the pool, right? So if already the child, you know, because some of those kids, like, as you said, if they were all getting really strong evidence-based, systematic, explicit tier one instruction, more of them are going to take off in their swimming skills right away. And those who don't, if they got really strong targeted tier two intervention, more still are going to be swimming, right? So we might have almost that entire pool of kindergartners swimming across, you know, without anyone standing there confused, not knowing what they're doing.
I love that analogy, the swimming analogy. It really helps to just like put it in context of something that's easy to understand. At the same time, learning to read and teaching reading isn't always so easy. I suppose teaching swimming isn't either, to be fair.
Probably not.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing or what you're thinking about sort of post-COVID, post-pandemic versus what you saw pre-pandemic. Are you already identifying things that are differently, either based on kids' behaviors or parents' needs, anything?
Yeah. So again, it's one of those things that can be a little bit difficult to tease out, but my concern, as it is, I'm sure, for all school staff trying to make classification decisions too, is how much, when I'm testing a child, you know, yesterday, the child that I saw yesterday, when his reading is, you know, at the, you know, two, three grade levels behind, not that I use grade levels, but just to use that as kind of an example, how much of that is due to having lost essentially a year of school or at least of reading instruction, right? So I have been surprised, maybe just because my own children's district has been in session since, you know, they missed last spring, but they've been in session. They were in session all the school year, but many, many schools were completely closed for most of this past school year, which, you know, those are the kids that I'm seeing. Now they are kids that legitimately, you know, they still have core phonologic deficits, right? So I know that they have absolutely indicators of dyslexia. Because they're in fourth grade, right? So missing 1 year of school in fourth grade doesn't give you a core phonologic deficit. But I also have to wonder what would have been different had they not missed a year of instruction. And that is, you know, one of the sort of, the word is flying out of my head, non-qualifiers, exclusionary clauses of the law, which is that it's not, and also in the dyslexia definition from my IDA, actually, that it's not caused by, lack of instruction. So it's not caused by excessive absences or a pandemic school shutdown. So there's that factor. The other interesting thing, though, when you bring up the pandemic, that reminds me, some of my clients, it's been very interesting to me because I just assume not being in school is very, very hard for most kids. But what I found was that it was one extreme or the other. For some kids, kids with executive deficits, executive function deficits, maybe co-occurring ADHD, it was an utter disaster because they just couldn't do the work independently. Or for younger kids who couldn't do any of the reading, so getting the work done, to, you know, reading the worksheet to do the worksheet was impossible, and it took a lot of parent oversight and parents were trying to work. For those kids, it was quite disastrous. But what I found for some of the older children, it seemed to be older children or children with some basic reading skills that they could compensate, some of them really preferred virtual school because it was less public and they could do it on their own time. And so they weren't doing the reading and the writing in such a public manner, and they could do things on their own time and they could listen, you know, they were automatically using the accommodations that technology lets us use. They were learning by listening and watching videos. And if they had to write, it would be with a word processor.
That's interesting. So essentially, back to your swimming analogy, they could practice in the pool by themselves without anybody watching to gain some confidence.
And use a flotation device while doing so, right? Their accommodations of technology were like a flotation device. Look at us with this analogy.
Look at, we're going somewhere with this. That's great. It must be summertime. We're thinking about the summer. So sort of thinking about the role of, you know, I have a couple more questions here. One of them is the role of teachers in identification. You know, so kids don't fall through the cracks. What kind of advice would you give to teachers?
Well, so the first, actually, even before I answer that question, let me just say this, because again, I am sensitive to the fact that when I say things like, you know, educators don't know this or aren't doing this, I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that they don't care. I don't think there's anyone who goes into teaching not caring about children and not wanting what's best for children. And so, you know, to go with the what we say a lot in the Reading League, and I've seen it all over the place now, when we know better, we do better, right? But what I'm surprised to find out is that many educators don't know about the child find clause in special education law. In fact, they don't know much about special education law, which I find really disconcerting. They should have been taught that. And you know, at the building level, they could certainly do a little study of the law. But child find says that it is our responsibility as educators to find children, to observe them, and notify, you know, the school team if we see any signs of a potential disability. And by that, I mean any signs of a potential disability. So while we are, as educators, all over the child abuse mandate, right? We all know we're mandated reporters as educators in a public school system, in private settings. Most people don't know that the child find is also a mandate. It is a mandate that when you see, you know, a little one. And I think what happens is teachers don't always, they can't quite put their finger on it. Right. So when the parent says, gee, I'm concerned, you know, so and they're young, especially too, right. I'm concerned because, you know, when I show him the word, what, he says, where or that or when, and the teacher says, you know, he's young, he'll get it. But sometimes the teachers are noticing that something's not quite right, but they haven't been taught to understand that. Right. And maybe, and by the way, I'm going to use this opportunity to jump back to something that you asked me that we didn't get to, which was the misconceptions of dyslexia. So maybe on top, right? Maybe on top of not quite being able to put their finger on what's wrong, maybe the parent says something, gee, you know, we do have a family history of dyslexia and I'm worried that that's what I'm seeing here. And the teacher goes, oh, no. Kids with dyslexia see things backwards. This isn't dyslexia. Your child, you know, doesn't see things backwards. Or, you know, the parent says, wow, my kid is still like doing reversals and I'm worried. And the teacher says, oh, reversals are perfectly normal. They are in very early readers. They're not in third and fourth grade. Right. And so if the teacher is still, you know, living under those common misconceptions because they haven't been trained adequately in dyslexia, then that's going to sort of lead things astray. Jerky eye movements is another misconception that's often, you know, that dyslexia is caused by jerky eye movements. And, you know, first of all, we know that it's in fact more a result of than a cause of dyslexia. But I have also had, I mean, so and not but, I have also had clients explain that to me very well. And the young woman that I said I had to record her, and she was the beginning, I actually now just record everybody so that I don't have to like go back and say, oh, hey, let me record you. So that's sort of obvious. Now I just go, I'm going to record our reading and I'll delete it even before you leave the parking lot. Don't worry. So when I watched her read, you could tell she was grabbing, and I've since asked kids and older dyslexics, they kind of grab the words that they know on the page. And I had one of my oldest dyslexics that I tested this past year, freshman in college, new identification, wildly dyslexic, but I won't go into that. But I had her be able to say to me, I just kind of scan the page. It's like I'm speed reading. And I look at the words that I know and I just kind of speed read those. But sometimes I realize I don't know something. So I jump back up and I pick up that, you know, so the jerky eye movements are more of a symptom than a cause of the dyslexia. So that's another common misconception. And the other one higher preponderance in boys than girls, we kind of addressed when I said boys are more likely to get identified because they're more likely to externalize that frustration and upset. But there, it does seem to have a fairly equal, in population studies, a fairly equal preponderance of boys and girls. The last one, again, we kind of touched upon was that it occurs only in highly gifted or very bright or very creative children. And that is one that I think is particularly dangerous, I guess. I think we've developed this romanticized notion and it feels good. I mean, as a parent of dyslexics, like, yeah, yes, my kids are very bright, very creative and dyslexic, right? That feels good. Yeah. And it may be true in some cases, of course. Of course, it's true in my precious babies. When we do that, we leave out a whole population of kids who are probably struggling even more than those kids, right? Because what we know from the research is that dyslexia can occur across a pretty broad spectrum of IQ. And not only that, the most important thing to know is that IQ is not predictive at all. I mean, within this sort of range of like 80 to above average. So there was studies done that said, you know, sort of the high IQ poor reader versus the lower IQ poor reader. And they matched them on reading skill and looked at how they responded to intervention. And IQ level did not predict how well kids responded to intervention. So that sort of lower IQ kid that, you know, isn't the classic gifted, you know, and it's classic, not that that exists, but our romanticized notion of creative, bright, dyslexic student wasn't any more likely to respond more quickly to a good systematic reading intervention than the kid with a sort of lower, flatter profile.
Those are really helpful misconceptions. And I would, one follow-up to that is, if a teacher is listening and says, yes, I really don't understand dyslexia, where would you recommend they go to get some more information about it?
The International Dyslexia Association website has so many very user-friendly resources. You know, there's like little one-page handouts, and that would be my first go-to. And then, you know, I mean, the Decoding Dyslexia is having chapters in so many states, and the Reading League, obviously, we're doing not usually focused on dyslexia except for the sessions that I teach. You know, so there's two sessions that we teach specifically about dyslexia. But, you know, one of my colleagues is teaching like a intro. I mean, so, well, Heidi teaches the Intro to Science of Reading for Educators, but there's another, Kelly Johnson is teaching course kind of like a mini Intro to Science of Reading for parents. To help them understand how reading develops and how we can support our kids' reading development. So, you know, there's so many great sites now and organizations that can help.
That's really helpful. And we can link our listeners in the show notes to some of those resources so they have a quick click so that they can find them easily. One last question for you as we sort of wrap up is for either teachers or parents, with a child that has dyslexia and is feeling frustrated or feeling like they're dumb, feeling like they can't do anything or engage in anything, what would your advice be in terms of helping them to develop some confidence?
Yeah, so this is where it's funny. I almost like go back into the gifts of dyslexia conversation, but I do feel like, not that I say dyslexia gives you gifts, but what I do say is find your child's interests or your student's interests and strengths and pursue those and give them opportunities to let those feed their soul. So from the parental perspective, identify what anything that your child's interested in. I mean, I think as a culture today, we all go like team sports. I mean, one of my kids is absolutely an athlete and a team sport kid, but like, and the other one is into engines and building, and the other one is into art and creating. So like, find where their interests are, and really foster those, and help them get feedback that feeds their soul. So whatever they're good at, help them be better at that. And so the same applies really in the classroom. I mean, there are ways to allow kids to use their strengths. So if we have to do a book report, does everyone have to write the book report? Does everyone have to give a speech? Or could we have an opportunity to, you know, draw a comic strip that illustrates our understanding of the book, or to make a little movie that illustrates our understanding of the book? Like, what are the ways that we can help the children be able to show their strengths and get acknowledged for their strengths, so that not only they can see themselves as competent, but their peers can too. I think we do that really well in athletics. Don't you think we do that really well in athletics? Like, you know, there are those kids who are maybe dyslexic or have a learning disability who excel in gym class and sports. And so that kind of, you know, everybody still thinks, oh, that's a great kid because they're good in sports. But we don't do that as well for the theater kids and the art kids and the, you know, so everybody needs to find their strength, and they need opportunities to be kind of stroked for those.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good advice. Helping a child find themselves as an individual and highlight that area, at the same time helping them become a better reader and getting them the resources that they need to make that happen.
Yeah. And teachers can really do a great job at that, you know? I mean, I've seen teachers really, like, you know, beef up, oh, look how good, you know, this whatever, the child who usually struggled with something, and really highlight something that they did really well. Or a classroom that I was in would be like, oh, well, you know, when we need to know how to spell a word, we ask, you know, Sally. And when we need to know how to solve a math problem, we ask Joe. And she would sort of like highlight everybody's strengths in that way. And in public ways, which, you know, but she found something for everybody. You know, this is your little posse of people that will help you here. And this is your posse of friends that will help you here. So it was public, but she included everybody in it. And it was beautiful.
That's great. What a great story to end on too. So we really appreciate you joining us. We appreciate your expertise and sharing all these resources with us. We also appreciate the work that you do. So thank you so much for what you're doing for kids and to help teachers and educators understand more about dyslexia and the effects.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with your listeners.
Thank you so much for listening, and keep your feedback coming. Want to learn more? Be sure to stay connected by subscribing to your favorite podcast app and join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. And visit amplify.com to check out our brand new resource site, offering all the tools and tips you need to continue on your Science of Reading journey. Until next time, keep the hope, take the action, and stay in touch. Let's get our kids to love reading.